Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
And Mairead McGuinness is here with us, European Commissioner for Financial Services, Financial Stability and Capital Markets Union. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Claire.
Thank you very much for coming in. We'll start local, will we? Leo Varadkar resigns and then suddenly everyone in Fine Gael is saying we need to reassess and we need to reconnect. I mean, it's bizarre really, because you're either very polite in the party or nobody, everybody was blinkered and nobody noticed that that needed to happen. What do you think was going on?
Well, I don't know because I'm not in the parliamentary party, so I can't answer that question. But it's not a week since, as you say, the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar stepped back. I mean, one of the things I think we should think about in the 6 days, if you like, since, is it's highly unusual, obviously, that a leader would do that. But it also takes somebody very brave to actually say, when I look at what he actually said, that you keep going until you can't. So as to your question about the mood in the party or the issues that are being raised, I suppose I'm not the right person to ask that question because I'm not privy to the conversations.
I suppose it's interesting, though, in a European context, isn't it? Because we hear a lot and we've been talking about it a lot in this programme in the context of the elections coming up, this drift to the right. And are you concerned about that happening in Ireland?
Well, I think that there is a belief that the next elections, so these ones that come up in June, will see a European Parliament that has more MEPs towards the right. I think what the centre is saying is that the centre needs to hold. And what I'm talking about there are like the EPP group in which Fine Gael sit, the Renew group in which Fianna Fáil sit, and indeed the Social Democrats. We don't have an Irish representative in that. Traditionally, and the European Parliament is different than normal parliaments. It's not a government and an opposition. Mm-hmm. So rather than going into work trying to attack the government, if you like, you go into work trying to see who do I agree with to get things done. It becomes more and more difficult to agree if there's a fragmented parliament. One of the interesting statistics was my first election to the European Parliament was 2004. And at that stage, the percentage of, if you like, radical right was not quite 9%. So that's 04. So 20 years on, the predictions, but it may turn out to be different, is that there would be 20%. So I think it's over time that's been happening. But what does that mean in terms of getting work done? Because even within those who might be described as the radical or the far right, they don't always agree with each other. And sometimes, indeed, the far right agree with the far left. So you get a very fragmented decision-making process. So when I was chairing debates in the European Parliament, very often, and chairing votes, it was quite interesting to see how the wings of the Parliament would tend to vote together. So extreme left and extreme right. But the holding of the centre is important to get work done. And I think that's going to be interesting to see. Now, the predictions at this stage, and it's far out, so there's huge uncertainty, is that in fact there won't be a huge surge to the far right and that the centre can hold.
Yeah, well, what do you think is going to happen in Ireland? Because we hear about, you know, going back to core values, talking about law and order, talking about migration, let's forget the woke agenda. That's what we're hearing, you know, that's what we're hearing a lot of at the moment. Do you think that that drift is happening here?
I think those issues are common across Europe. And I don't regard it as a drift. I think you have to listen to what people are saying on the ground on all of those topics, including housing here in Ireland is a huge issue. And migration is an issue because it's linked to housing. So there are lots of issues that are there. But equally, if you look at some of the longer term projects that we're trying to work on, tackling climate change and biodiversity loss, we have farmers on the streets of Brussels again today protesting. And I think it signifies that the work we're trying to do in this transition, both green and digital, is difficult for societies, the cost of living pressures for everybody. So I don't think that the issues are a surprise. I don't think they should be taken as a reflection of a complete swing to a far position, because as I said, sometimes it's far right and far left. It just reflects issues that people are talking about on the ground, and they're talking about these topics across Europe.
Now, can I ask you whether you've spoken to Simon Harris about your own position and your own future as European Commissioner? Have you had time to have that conversation with him?
Well, I have to say one thing and to thank him publicly, because the Minister, Simon Harris, tried to call me on Thursday of last week and I missed his call because I was busy. And then, of course, he was even busier. But he called me Saturday evening. And my view then was, look, you have more things to worry about, but I will be meeting him and we'll be talking about lots of things, particularly European, because coming back to your comment about the topics, I mean, the big topics in Europe today, including migration, but also the future of the European budget, how will we handle enlargement? Security and defence are huge
now,
topics.
Now, you've moved off your own future there, and yeah. I do want to ask you about that, because you made it clear the last time you were in that you would like to continue.
Yeah.
And since then, Micheál Martin said, well, now, hang on a second, that's in our gift. That's in Fianna Fáil's gift to decide who goes.
Full respect to that. This is a government decision. So, I mean, I'm happy that you're concerned about my future. I've given up even worrying about that. I have a job to do, probably till maybe October, November. I am willing to serve again, but I'll say two words. I have no sense of entitlement or expectation. When I speak to Simon Harris, I'm sure we'll talk about many things, and maybe this as well. Mm-hmm. But he is part of a government, and that government has to make the big decisions, including about who will be the next Irish commissioner. Yeah. It's an important job.
But do you accept that Fianna Fáil has the right now to decide who the next commissioner is, that is in their gift? I mean, Micheál Martin says that's essentially a done deal. Fianna Fáil have that.
Well, I'll say one thing. I have an extremely good relationship with the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, both when he was Taoiseach and now, including his work on Gaza. So I have no issue with his view, if that is as he has expressed it. But let's see how things evolve, because one never knows in all of the uncertainties what will happen. And I don't spend my days worrying about that. I have lots of other things to worry about.
How does it work? So say, I mean, it looks very likely now that Ursula von der Leyen will be continuing on. She's got the support and the nomination of the EPP, and on it goes from there. Does she have a say in who her commissioners are?
Well, I suppose the president of the commission, yes, they're given names by the member states, and member states' governments, it's their prerogative to propose. If you saw what happened the last time, I mean, it was quite extraordinary. First of all, she was the first woman ever. That's incredible. And secondly, she did ask member states to put forward a woman and a man. And to some extent, I benefited from that selection process. I mean, there were other reasons why I hope she chose me, for experience, etc., because I've 16 years served in the European Parliament. So I think that it looks like she is our EPP candidate and will lead the commission. I imagine she will have a similar view around, you know, gender issues, but also around possibly experience. We're coming out of a really difficult commission, lots of big geopolitical things, but lots of local things. And that is reflected with grassroots concerns amongst many of the topics you've mentioned. And things won't be easier for the next commission, because competitiveness is now a big topic. Europe is sliding in that regard. The work I'm doing on trying to create capital market union, which is basically trying to make sure we have enough finance to finance SMEs, large companies, startups and innovators. We don't have that in Europe. And we've had a strong push. Now, it's a big political job, but the leaders are keen to see this done. So Europe has found itself perhaps more vulnerable because of the Russian illegal invasion of Ukraine, our energy overdependence on that particular state, the need to invest, and on many areas, supply chain topics as well. So, you know, this is not, this is a tough time now, and I think it's going to be tougher in the future.
So who's winning that competitiveness battle globally?
Well, we compare ourselves obviously with the US, and clearly the US is different than Europe. We know that. It can do things on tax, it can do things quicker, it can give supports and subsidies. And there was a real concern with the Inflation Reduction Act in the US that we would lose industries. So high energy users might be tempted to go and get subsidies and build their infrastructure there. And that's why the availability of capital to fund these companies, including the availability of energy that's at a lower cost, these are crucial to industry, to manufacturing, to processing. And I think that we now know that we need both. We need sustainability and competitiveness to be on the agenda together, and they're not in conflict. And sometimes I worry that it's either one or the other. But if you look at what's happening, I mean, rain, I mean, it's been raining, I was going to say cats and dogs, but it's been raining very heavily. I live on a farm. It's extremely difficult in the countryside at the moment. Farmers cannot get animals out, whether it's lambs or cows, are trying to do it. And it doesn't look like the rain is going to stop anytime soon. But that's a function of, we've been warned, warmer and wetter. How are we going to adjust our food production to deal with the impacts of climate change?
Well, you've heard what the farmers have to say about that? You've already mentioned the protests that are happening in Brussels. We've seen them in Paris. We've seen them in Germany. We know how farmers feel here about the nature restoration law. I mean, how do you bring those along with you?
Well, I think we could have done a better job in allowing the leadership of farmers. And on the ground, there's an amazing group of farmers, you know, who farm for nature and who tell other farmers. So I wouldn't say that it's an either or here, because a lot is happening on the ground. I think it's more about the how. I don't think any farm organisation here in Ireland or Europe is a climate denier. They see it. Look, as I said, conditions at the moment in Ireland, nor are any of them, you know, so that they want to destroy biodiversity. They live on these places. I'm always delighted to see the wildlife on a farm,
but they feel left behind.
And I've said this.
And the nature restoration law, we had the IFA in twice on this, and they say, there's no plan in place. We're told that you have to do all of these things, but we don't know what's going to happen in response to that. That's a precarious place to be for any business.
It is. And the uncertainty and this feeling that they weren't part of the conversation. But look what's happened now with the Nature Restoration Law. The European Parliament have okayed it. The member states, I think there's five or six member states who've said, no, we won't vote for this. So the vote on that for the council, for the member states, is pushed back to after the European election. So it's not a done deal yet. So there's not just issues in Ireland. There are concerns across Europe. And we need to think and do things better. And rather than thinking that if you protect habitats on your farm, that it's a cost to you, it's also an investment. As I've said before, I'm not a great believer in schemes. And sometimes I think farm organisations push for schemes that are time limited and don't have a long-term impact. So we need to adjust our thinking to what works on farms and what works for nature. One of the things I've said several times, the old common agriculture policy, up until recently, we penalised farmers for having a habitat like rushes or a wet spot or a big...
Because it was all about
unproductive
beef.
Unproductive, because it was called, you know, it wasn't in good agricultural condition. Now we know, and we've said, we will pay you on these, so you don't have to take them out. But we've actually a long mindset of a farmers who would have started farming in that way of driving on, and that was the mantra of even the advisory system.
Irrigating
in the 70s
land.
And 80s. Irrigation, draining, we provided grants. How do we change the attitudes? And you change attitudes by listening to people and showing them that these things are not against you. It's because we're trying to do it for a future.
So now you're saying that didn't happen. That's a failing of the EU, surely.
Well, I've said that. I mean, this is not breaking news for me. I think if you see things getting huge resistance, you have to question yourself, not those who are actually doing the protesting. And the other thing about farmers' protests, it's not about one issue. It's about many issues. I noted that in the 20 years that I was in the Parliament, the farmer representative voices in Ireland, for example, moved from maybe two or three to many. Mm-hmm. And that's a function also what's happening in politics, that you're seeing many voices and people are voting, and it is their right to do that, for the voice that they say echoes their view. But that doesn't allow great progress, because it's very hard to reconcile some of those voices which are in conflict so deeply they can't compromise.
Now, we heard overnight that the British government played a role in convincing the United States not to veto that UN Security Council vote on calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and in the Middle East. What does that vote mean for the EU and its stance on Israel? Like, you have now a more isolated Israel sitting there.
Yeah, and I think Israel has been warned about that, that that was the inevitability. If they couldn't see the humanitarian disaster that is unfolding and the potential famine, the European Council, the leaders, including Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, were very strong in their support for humanitarian pause and a ceasefire. So I think that the world, I mean, some would say very late in the day, but the world is speaking better with one voice. They're trying to stop Israel going into Rafah and making things much worse. I mean, it is quite extraordinary and very hard to get your head around the fact that there are miles of trucks with food and they're not being allowed into the region, into Gaza. And the sad part is that if I reflect on the comments from Israel, I don't think they've changed their minds. So it is really an imperative that we use every way possible to get food in, even including, and Ursula von der Leyen is also involved in this whole humanitarian effort of getting in what
from
we can
Cyprus. I
from
just
Cyprus.
I wonder, do you have a consideration about the implications of the EU now that the UN US is distancing itself from Israel. What does that mean for the EU?
Well, I think, the EU and some leaders, including the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and indeed the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, with others in Europe, those voices are growing. So in the beginning, there were very few around the table. I would have voiced the Irish views to colleagues. Mm. Not everybody would have agreed with it. But there are now more countries realising that we cannot avert our gaze, that you have to look and see what's happening on the ground. You have to listen to what the UN is saying. And you cannot allow that children become the victims of something that they had nothing to do with, notwithstanding the horrors of what happened in October in Israel and that there are still hostages there. But, for the sake of the children, we're approaching Easter and all that accompanies that with hope and spring and looking to a better future. But in Gaza, they see no future, and it is quite awful if that is to prevail.
Maureen McGuinness, EU Commissioner, thank you for joining us. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.